I'm Chris Rebelo for California Healthline. State Senator Deborah Ortiz chairs the California Senate's Health Committee. In a recent interview, Ortiz answered questions about the current legislative session, expected battles with Governor Schwarzenegger, and the long-term outlook for changes in health care in California. So the first question for you is, I want to talk to you about specific bills, specific efforts that the legislature is going to be doing, taking stock of this year in regards to health care. But obviously, a key issue is the relationship between the legislature and the governor, because no matter what comes out of the House or Senate or out of the legislature, the governor has power to veto. What's the overall situation with that relationship?
Well, I think it's fair to say that it is one that is changes on a regular basis. In some respects, it generally starts out that he's open to ideas and cooperation, and ultimately does something contrary to that. So I think there are opportunities, but ultimately there really is no certainty in between what the governor says he's going to do and what he ultimately does. And that's a difficulty. You can't really anticipate where he's going to finally end up. And although this year he appears to certainly want to try to find some common ground, and the test really is going to be in, you know, what the budget finally looks like and whether or not he ultimately vetoes bills or signs bills. And unfortunately, many of the bills that he vetoed of mine last year, we had no indication until the last couple of days in which issues were raised that had never been raised. This year, clearly, his budget has identified some problems that are real problems and bottom line issues for Democrats. For example, the 5% cut, not in Medi-Cal reimbursement rates, and we've been very adamant about wanting to restore that 5%, which is still underfunded for Medi-Cal anyway, as well as issues like not allowing the COLA to be put in place for the aged, blind, and disabled. And so his first showing of this budget, there were some problems, and we will see where the legislative strategy ends up. But it's hard to predict, quite frankly.
Well, when you talked about the cutbacks in Medi-Cal reimbursements, that's the question that's at the top of my list. Are there efforts underway in the legislature to rescind what the governor did in the beginning of the year, cutting Medi-Cal payments to docs by 5% in the state?
Yes, we've already got a vehicle moving through the process. I believe it came out of the budget subcommittee, which doesn't really require a policy hearing in my policy committee, go directly to the floor to restore that 5%. So we've already established that, and we've got a vehicle moving through the process. And, you know, it's interesting because that's likely to have bipartisan support. It is one of the things that in the past we have found common ground with Republicans on that reimbursement debate. Unclear where they're going to fall, given that it's the governor's cut. But yes, that is certainly moving through the process. And the sad thing is, restoring that 5%, it really still doesn't solve the problem of very few providers and still underfunding, in general, any Medi-Cal reimbursement rate as it relates to the cost of the service. So that's certainly something that we're moving through, and it's very important for us to not allow that cut to occur.
And at this point, given the governor's action in January, I would think that he could likely veto something like this?
Well, you know, it depends. I mean, he could veto a bill. We could rewrite the rate increase in the budget. And we have a couple of ways that we can do this. Obviously, there's the legislative bill that gets on his desk that he signs or doesn't sign. And there's also the ability to do it in the budget. And then if we come to agreement on all other matters, does he veto the budget because of this provision, or does he try to exercise his blue pencil authority to simply take the money out for the reimbursement rate restoration? I think there are going to be far more contentious issues to disagree with the legislature on, and I think there's a greater likelihood that we will have bipartisan support on this. So I don't know if it's our biggest fight. It's a priority for the legislature, but I don't know if it's where the governor's going to throw down the gauntlet, quite frankly. There's no way to predict.
So what do you see as some of your biggest fights this coming session?
Well, I think restoring the COLA to the aged, blind, and disabled, that we passed a budget last year in which we did not trigger that COLA increase, which was a real problem for many of us. but we had to do it. It was a bottom line with the Republicans and the governor. So we've come back and said, you know, we can't let the aged, blind, and disabled suffer another year. So that's going to be a very big issue, and we may, you know, we'll see where that ends up. But unfortunately, that may be one of our battles. We also have the question of legal immigrants who are here who, for the last 2 5-year cycles, have been denied aged, blind, and disabled benefits, and this was the year to have allowed those to occur, and the governor has proposed not funding those and requiring them to wait another 5 years, which would be in total a 10 or 15-year denial of a very vulnerable population. So I suspect that'll be a bit of a battle with the governor. You know, the governors, we generally see child care cuts and proposals and or programs that the counties administer for caseload that is probably going to be a bit of a battle with us and the governor as well.
What about your efforts to establish a new Department of Public Health to separate that out of the Department of Health Services?
One of my favorite efforts, public health in general has been something I've worked on for throughout my legislative career, at least, nearly 10 years now. I believe we may have an opportunity to actually create an independent, freestanding, either department level or cabinet level, you know, Department of Public Health. And the reason that we may have the opportunity this year is that there have been countless studies over the years, pre-9/11, but certainly since 9/11, between the Little Hoover Commission, the RAND Corporation, an independent federal study that analyzed every state that showed that we were ill-prepared to respond to bioterrorism, primarily as a function of not as much priority in public health intervention prevention, as well as I think the political momentum that was created as a result of I think a transition of the one key public health person in the department, Dick Jackson, last year that created a huge discussion and debate that came to the forefront with the public. There may be an opportunity indeed to get that bill signed this year, although I think it's fair to say there's a disagreement between Secretary Belshay has been very clear and has not supported the concept, despite the fact that the governor's own CPR or California policy document that he convened when he first came in to look at streamlining government, in fact, suggested that we create, you know, and break up the Department of Public Health. But there is potentially an opportunity with others that are around the governor who are saying this is a sound and good thing to do for California. So we have CMA, of course, supporting that. The public health officers for years have been the troops at the ground level who have been awesome. And my hope is that I will be able to see this happen before I leave the legislature this year.
All right. How about efforts to ensure universal coverage for every Californian? I know there's SB 840, which was introduced by Sheila Kuhl. You're a co-author of that. Long shot, I'm assuming. What's the status of those efforts?
Well, I think Senator Kuhl obviously has introduced again her bill. The problem has not been the legislature. We've moved that bill along. Whether or not it gets signed this year, I can't predict. I suspect not, simply because there are some entrenched interests that would not want to see this occur. And it is a massive undertaking. It's where we need to go and should go as a state. But, you know, efforts have failed on the federal level, but it is an ideal solution that we're not likely to see in this session, at least. But you know what? Who knows? Maybe there's an opportunity down the road. Senator Kuhl has a couple more years in the legislature than I do, and she deserves a lot of credit for leading this and, you know, working through it. All the data and studies suggest that in time, California could save money. The quality of delivery of health care would improve. It's a massive restructuring, and those kinds of changes, even though warranted, don't often occur in this kind of a political context.
Carol Migden has introduced legislation that would require businesses with more than 10,000 employees to spend at least 8% of their total wages on health care benefits. What's your take on that effort?
It is the model that is sort of in conflict with what Senator Kuehl is doing. I mean, do we try to maximize an employer-based system of providing health care coverage, or do we go to this universal kind of state overseeing and maximizing numerous programs that the Kuehl proposal suggests? Senator Migdon's proposal is a variation of SB 2 that Senator Burton obviously carried and was successful and got signed, and then unfortunately the business community went to the ballot and repealed it. But I think it's an ambitious undertaking. It covers a part of the population. It's a twist on SB 2. And if indeed it's successful, I fear that the business community will go back to the ballot and once again defeat it. Any and all approaches are really a symptom of this huge problem we have in California, that 6 million Californians lack health care. A good chunk of those are children. A huge percentage of them are working poor Californians, and we have failed them. And each of these approaches attempts to address some or a significant part of this problem. So, Senator Migdon's proposal will certainly find support in my committee. Whether or not it makes it off the floor is going to be a challenge, given that some, even Democrats, are not inclined to necessarily impose, as they see, an unreasonable burden on businesses. But I think it's the policy direction we need to go to. But that's the debate in California. Are we going to stay in an employer-based model, or do we move to another model? And that's one of the huge issues that we as a state have not come to consensus on.
And even Democrats are not in agreement, obviously.
I think it's fair to say, yes, that there are some Democrats that may not agree to this, and therein lies part of the problem. If we can't come to consensus, then it's difficult sometimes to ask the public at large to understand what is the best solution. And they expect us to handle these problems, and they're not easy problems, as you well know. And I don't know that the legislative arena is ever going to be the way to address that, nor the initiative process. And a lot of this direction has to come from the federal government. And we've seen variations of that attempted and failed on a federal level.
You just spoke about initiative efforts. I wanted to ask you about relief for the high cost of prescription drugs. Last year, we had the fight between Prop 78 and Prop 79. Any activity likely in the legislature this year? Is that issue going to come back?
There's talk that some discussions are going on, that a truce would like to be arrived at, I think, from the leadership in the assembly, and I'm not sure what's going on with our pro tem. And as you know, or maybe you don't, I'm sure you do know, I actually stepped out there and carried the bill as I was approached by the Schwarzenegger administration to carry a legislative approach to create a discount drug program with the participation of the pharmaceutical industry. And my efforts to do that were failed. I failed in getting that bill out of my committee. Labor worked very hard to kill that bill. It had less to do with the substance of the bill, in my mind, than the battle at the ballot on these other measures. And unfortunately, hundreds of millions of dollars were spent and wasted, in my mind, on defending or defeating the two proposals that were on the ballot. Any way that you looked at the legislative proposal that I authored that was a work in progress, and we were likely to get some improvements in the assembly side with the industry, at least based on my discussions with them, would have provided 5 to 7 million Californians who don't have a discount drug program or any prescription drug coverage a discount program. And they are all working poor. About 70% of them were Latino, and unfortunately got killed in the initiative war. There is some talk that they have, at least the so-called Health Access Coalition that defeated my bill, have now proposed to the leadership of both houses that the hybrid model that was identified in the LAO report, which was essentially my bill, that they would welcome some discussion on that being the model. And that was the discussion that should have occurred last year, but for the political battle that occurred. So at least there's a willingness to say, oh, yeah, maybe we could have done this. And again, it's one of the things that I'm not likely to see in my time in the legislature. So a willingness to talk, but I don't know that we get past some of the interest groups that on both sides of this, whether it's the pharmaceutical industry or some who you know, are believe that others who opposed my bill, I'm not sure that that resolution could be reached this year. It should, and we failed 5 to 7 million Californians last year.
Were you surprised that both initiatives were voted down?
No, I'm not. I actually, you know, I predicted they would be, and just so that the people have to understand, the proponents of the measure that was billed as the consumer measure that would have used Medi-Cal patients and beneficiaries as the leverage, and many of the poverty groups opposed that so-called consumer proposal for that very reason, which was my reason for opposing it as well. Many of those groups, I mean, they qualified their measure for the ballot, and not that the pharmaceutical industry is without blame, trust me. There's a lot of reason for criticism and distrust. And however, their reason for going to the ballot was because, indeed, the other group went to the ballot, and they had to put themselves in a position where they said, we wanted a legislative remedy. Now we're in a position where we not only have to defend this measure that's on the ballot, we have to put our own up. So am I surprised they failed? No, simply because the public finally said, you know what, there's too much confusion on the arguments on both sides of these, the proponents of these. And you know what? When I'm unsure about something, I'm voting no. And that is what every initiative in the past that is confusing has demonstrated. There isn't trust even when a group proposes that and both groups did propose they were helping the poor. But the public, you know, exercised common sense and said, you know what, I don't trust either side. Unfortunately, again, hundreds of millions of dollars were used or wasted, essentially, to achieve that.
Can you give us an update on what's being done with this gnarly transition to Medicare drug benefits?
Yeah. Probably one of the saddest points in this country's history of a deal that was cut in the late hours of Congress 2 years ago, in which many, many people voted for the proposal. It was bad policy when they enacted it. We knew it was going to be bad policy when it hit the states. My committee and I personally held 3 hearings over the last year and a half early on, and we brought the federal government in via phone and walked through the problems of this program. And so what is happening? California, as well as 28 other states, stepped in and said, oh my God, people are suffering and they're not able to get life-saving medication. They've been put in programs that their pharmacists can't determine and assess whether or not they're in or eligible for these programs. And they're paying huge co-pays in a world in which if they were what we call the Medi-Medis, Medicare Part D in California, not only were they poor, therefore they received a Medi-Cal benefit prior to this, but they're also aged or disabled, so therefore Medicare eligible, in which they never had a prescription drug program. So they go in assuming that their Medi-Cal coverage will allow them to have that relationship with their pharmacist, and they find out they're now in Medicare Part D, and Medicare Part D has not transmitted the information to their pharmacist, and they're being told if you need these 1 to 16 monthly medications that you live on, it's going to cost you hundreds of dollars. It's an absolute nightmare. So what did California do? We stepped in, we approved on an emergency basis, bipartisan, $150 million to flow down to, you know, the pharmacists to make sure that they just give the prescription drugs and they get reimbursed. Well, even as we've stepped in, many pharmacists aren't aware that this benefit exists, so they're still hesitating whether they can give somebody life-saving prescription drugs because they don't know that they're going to get reimbursed by the state of California temporarily. We've extended this till May 17th or so when the next category of Medicare recipients are going to hit this new program and have problems as well. And all we're being told by the federal government is, you know what? Go to the plans that these people have been put into and get reimbursement for them. That's the tip of the iceberg, unfortunately. The real problem with this program is that when Congress passed it, it was carte blanche to the pharmaceutical industry. They did not retain the ability for the government to negotiate lower prices. So pharmaceutical companies get to set the prices without any government negotiation to assure that those prices are low or lower than the market rate. Secondly, they did not require the pharmaceutical companies or the plans that are implementing these programs to assure continuity or certainty that the same formulary will exist month to month. So if you're a senior who has medications for lowering your cholesterol or, you know, statins, or you have a heart medication for, you know, arrhythmia or something, or you are a diabetic who does well on one type of diabetic medication and you're thrown into or you sign up with one company and you get your medication that month, the next month you go in, your pharmacist could say to you, sorry, Mrs. Smith, that company that you're in or that plan that you're in no longer provides those pharmaceuticals this month. So there's no continuity that those same prescription drugs will always be available. Well, they can change, you know, the beneficiary, the Mrs. Smith, can change every month and move to another plan. But my God, the confusion or even the capacity to do that is too much for someone who's young, educated, resourceful, and has 8 hours in a day to do all of this. That's not the average Medicare Part D recipient.
Well, as far as these emergency steps to take care of it, this is one area where it seems like bipartisan support in the governor. Are you all on the same page as far as this goes?
We're all on the same page of approving the money. We're not all on the same page of pointing fingers at why this has failed. There's a little bit of trepidation, discomfort. Oh, no, let's not beat up the Republican administration or the federal administration on how bad this program is. And I think there's been a really tepid insistence on the part of the governor to demand that the state of California get reimbursed. I mean, I think the governor needs to be more aggressive to say we absolutely have to get reimbursed, President Bush and federal government. And I'm going to lead the congressional delegation in California to insist on it. And I'm going to give an example to other states who may or may not have Republican or Democratic governors that they should join us in demanding the same. So it stops short of pointing the finger at this administration on the Republican side. And but truth be told, I think the Democrats that voted for this proposal ought to also be keenly aware of the fact that many of them approved this plan. I mean, a handful of them in Congress and the House refused to vote on it. But, and I know Boxer didn't vote for the Medicare prescription drug bill, but I believe Senator Feinstein did. But she's also at least taken leadership to try to fix this. But let's, I mean, I think many people were sold a bill of goods, you know, and it was truly, literally, like at 2 in the morning or 12 midnight, with very little review of what was done when they passed this Medicare Part D and Medicare restructuring plan.
You mentioned, obviously, the administration. Another thing that the Bush administration is pushing is health savings accounts as part of the solution or a big part of the solution to our health care woes. What's your take on them, and do you think the legislature will be addressing anything surrounding health savings accounts?
The health savings accounts have been around for a long time, the concept. The legislative proposals, I mean, I carried one about 3 years ago, I think. Democrats and Republicans have carried them. But really, it's an imperfect, partial solution. One, it is sort of the free market argument that everybody, even the poor, can have these accounts and get a tax credit and a tax benefit for doing this. And, you know, that's the solution to providing health care for everybody in the country. So it's a private sector argument that ignores the reality of the very working poor not having the discretionary dollars nor the likely tax benefit that would go to them or the companies is not enough to address the bulk of the 6 million Californians who are uninsured in the state of California. But it is the alternative to a government-funded program or a program that really saturates and looks at the reality of our workforce in California. You have very poor, very working poor. You have transitory. You have a larger gap, a growing gap that continues between the working poor and the wealthy. And the middle class is falling down in their ability to keep up with the cost. So these tax credit models are fine if you have very wealthy beneficiary or company that can actually do that. But many companies who have proposed these models for themselves, small businesses, actually have found them to be too burdensome for a small business to even structure for their workers. And the workers' contribution has to be small enough that it reflects their limited income. The benefit to the employer has to be large enough to overcome the bureaucracy and sort of the reimbursement timeline. And in the end, government has to pay part of that premium cost. There's no way for it not to have a government subsidy to meet the cost of these the premiums and the administration of these programs.
Back to California. Can you put your futuristic hat on, and obviously can't hold you to anything, but at the end of the year, at the end of the session, after everything's landed on the governor's desk, do you think there's going to be anything different as far as health care is concerned for folks who live in California? What's going to be different?
Well, the rosiest picture is we actually increased eligibility for healthy families and the children in the state of California. I think the most urgent priority is how we get children insured. I think there's a small opportunity, in fact, to try to push that, and maybe indeed there's a glimmer of hope with this administration, is solely for political reasons, to find a way to increase eligibility rather than, as his budget now proposes, simply increasing funding for outreach of the currently eligibles that are not enrolled. I think that this is the most critical issue, is that we have children who are not insured. So maybe we see some movement in that, if only, again, for the governor's reelection political purposes. But I think, genuinely, there may be, on some personal level, a desire to do that. Whether he can overcome Republicans who oppose expansion of that program is another question. Do I see greater accountability on the part of the plans to allow or not reduce the scope of coverage of those who already have coverage? I'm a little bit concerned about that kind of contraction of plans that may indeed begin to ration those who do have coverage to some smaller level. We have a huge hospital financing problem. The solution we had 2 years ago or a year ago failed to resolve the problem of reimbursement rates, as well as some hospitals who serve large populations of uninsured or underinsured. And the conflict will be, do we ease these hospitals from seismic safety requirements, which are very expensive, but in turn not require them to increase their charity care or the manner in which they charge uninsured at a rate that is aligned with what insurance plans get paid for comparable services. This is something I've battled for 4 years. So if indeed we're going to ease some of the restrictions on hospitals, as we should, that are huge costs to them, we should expect from them to enforce consistently what is now a voluntary charity care policy for those who are uninsured, so that they don't take their homes when they can't make these payments when they come into a hospital. So, you know, my hope is that there's going to be resolution on that. And more importantly, some of the more vulnerable parts of our state, the rural areas, the areas that have huge unemployment rates and huge populations of working poor, whether or not we can keep some of those hospitals operating and opened. And we have a huge, huge disaster waiting to happen and already happening in hospital closures in those very vulnerable areas of the state of California. If we solve some of those issues this year, we will have come a long way. But what do we do with those slightly increased revenues? You know, I think it needs to go to the most vulnerable in the state, and long-term investment of the number one issue in every person's mind, which is healthcare access.
Do I hear discouragement as far as hoping to be able to take some bold action and get that in place?
Bold action in an election year, after the kind of fatigue and polarization and battle that the legislature had with the governor last year, I think is being far too rosy of an outlook. The institution is not necessarily designed for bold action. It's incremental. And it's incremental for a reason. You have very little common ground in the state of California when you have a very high threshold of two-thirds vote to appropriate, to pass a budget, to create a new level of revenue. And there's a structural impediment to bold action, and it's called a two-thirds vote, and it's called very polarized views of the world when it comes to the two sides of the aisle. So yes, it's a bit discouraging, but we'll see some highlights. We'll hopefully see a Department of Public Health. We'll hopefully see more children with health care coverage. And you know, we definitely have to have the 5% restoration in Medi-Cal rate. And you know, beyond that, we'll see where the state goes.
Final thing, another thing that I just saw on my list, you're back to basic goals. There's an item to develop strategies for recruiting, training, and bringing in nurses, shortage of nurses in California. Everybody's familiar with the governor's past battles with the California Nursing Association. Do you think there's going to be any action on this front?
Opportunity, I think. Perhaps some common ground. I'd like to see that. It's something that's been done in past years. I had a bill to fund it at that time was $60 million to increase financing to the institutions that provide nurses training. We saw some of the hospitals start their own initiatives, again, going directly to the question of easing the nurse ratio requirement that's in the law. The governor stepping in and saying, I'm going to commit X number of dollars and have it flow to the community colleges and the CSUs that are the primary institutions for training nurses would go a long way to what is a long-term problem, quite frankly. So if we educated and began, you know, nursing programs next year with state financing to the institutions that do the training, it's still going to take us 15, 20 years to reach the capacity of our growing population. I mean, and how far behind we are in nurse training and our nurse shortage problem. So it has to be not just this year, but it has to be institutionalized, that it's a part of our long-term infrastructure to our healthcare system of staying committed to nurse training.
Final thing, anything I haven't asked you, Senator Ortiz, that you think policymakers, people who care about healthcare, need to know about what's coming up, what's on the agenda this year?
Well, you know, I certainly am going to try to tackle before I leave how we assure that the $3 to $7 billion of taxpayer money that's going into stem cell research, in fact, benefits all Californians. And it's a pretty huge endeavor in that it's going to take two sides of the aisle, two houses, and a governor's signature. But I think it goes beyond the serum and the future of stem cell research. It goes to the very credibility of the initiative process where people voted and cared about this and defied all of the arguments about stem cell research is killing a life or that it was fiscally unsound to do this kind of investment, huge investment. It symbolizes to me the very sensitive kind of tipping point we are in California right now where the voters are so distrustful of government, of elected officials. They're speaking through the initiative process. And if we fail them in that vote on something that grand and that big, they will turn away from the initiative process as well and begin to, as they probably have and certainly demonstrated last November, will lose all faith in the electoral process. And so, you know, my personal feelings about this issue are pretty strong and compelling, but I think every elected official who is serving now or plans to serve in the future has to understand that interrelationship of the initiative process and what we do or fail to do in the legislature. And that is part of our obligation as well to assure that the integrity and the openness and actually delivering on what it is the voters voted for goes to the heart of the democratic process. And again, the institution ought to be revered rather than reviled, and we have an obligation to play a role in that system to work towards restoring some integrity and trust in the system.
I'm Chris Rebelo for California Healthline.